IVM.
Welcome to All Things Policy, a podcast on everything from employment to aircraft carriers.
We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Number Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs.
I'm Yazad, an economist.
And I'm Shambhavi, a cell biologist.
Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. Today we have Manoj and Aditya, and we're going to be discussing military education, specifically in India and China. So Aditya, tell us something about military education in India.
Well, I'm going to talk specifically about a paper or an article which proposes greater civilian involvement in professional military education in India. And it argues that this hasn't happened because of the nature of civil-military relations in this country. Basically, if you go back to 1959, Samuel Huntington, who we have dissed in this podcast last week, had this concept of objective control, by which he meant that there ought to be some very strict separations between the civilian and military domains in order to have a sort of balance between them. So the military would take care of military matters, operational issues, and in exchange, the civilians would maintain complete control. This was sort of the bargain that was struck in India after the 1962 war, where all the fighting is entirely the military's domain. The civilians don't even ask questions there, but the civilians get to take call about when military operations should occur, when they should stop, so on. And what this paper by Anit Mukherjee, who's a professor at RSIS in Singapore, is arguing is that this compact has actually denied our military, professional military education in which civilians are deeply involved. And he cites several studies that show a correlation, not necessarily a causation, but a correlation between professional military education and military effectiveness. And I think the key distinction here to understand is the difference between training and education. Training is I learn how to sail my ship, how to fly my plane, how to shoot my rifle. Education is I learn defense economics, I learn management, I learn engineering, I learn strategy in international relations. And there is a difference in them because education, by its nature, demands critical thinking.
So what I can understand from it is training is more, how to do something, while education is, looking at a much larger, more intangible kind of topic. So like engineering, how to do the math of engineering, not how to kind of build a plane.
Exactly, yes. So there's one quote that says, one trains for certainty, whereas education trains for handling uncertainty. So I think education also trains you about how to think about something rather than just how to do something. Anit Mukherjee makes the argument that civilians are much better equipped than military people to do this. One, military people usually don't have the training, they keep rotating out. Whereas you have civilian academics who have the grounding. And he says that, of course, this has to be, civilian involvement has to be grounded in the operational realities of the military. But it should also have, that those people should also enjoy academic freedom that questions myths of an organization, that questions accepted paradigms. And he's saying that this doesn't happen because civilians lack expertise, especially in a country like India. Now, I'm not sure this is necessarily true with, say, management, for instance, or technology management or engineering. But I think a lot of strategic issues, international relations, defense economics, I think we need more expertise in this country and more civilians involved in that part of the education. And he does, Anit Mukherjee does point out that there is a potential pitfall here, which is that civilian involvement has to be done very carefully. It has to be well-intentioned because it's very easy to bring in, to smuggle in a political ideology. Mm-hmm. And there are obviously examples of this throughout the 20th century. But even in developed countries, you've had problems. In Sweden, he cites Sweden as an example where involvement of civilians in military education actually resulted in a sort of civilianization of the military bureaucracy. So, which sounds like a very Swedish thing to happen. But yeah, so he does point to some pitfalls there. And yeah, that's the crux of Anit Mukherjee's paper.
That's quite interesting, so he's broadly talking about a professional force which is leveraging different skill sets from different people and a different form of education. And he's wary about a ideology sort of seeping into the military. Which is quite different to this
paper. I assume in China, the ideology takes precedence.
Absolutely. And that's the difference between, say, this division that you were talking about, where the civilians sort of take control of a certain sphere and the military takes control of a certain sphere. And that's because the force is not of a party or of a government per se. It's responsible to the state, which is very obviously different in China. It's a communist country. The army, the forces are the party's forces, as opposed to, you know, you pledge loyalty to the party as opposed to the state. And the effort is sort of to bring, fuse the party and the state together. So what I have to say is diametrically sort of opposed to this. So there was a paper that I was reading by Juliette Genevaz, if I've not butchered the name. But what it basically argues is that it looks at university defense education. So instead of sort of looking at bringing civilians into the sort of military in terms of education and their skills, this is about taking military education to civilians and particularly to university students. The most common perception is that this started happening in China. And I'm talking about the sort of post-reform period, 1978, after that. Obviously, before that, under Mao, there was a Cultural Revolution. So you had the Red Guards. It was very different. But after you started to sort of break this up and you said Deng Xiaoping takes over and he starts talking about creating this sort of divide and not polarizing society to that level, you try to look at, okay, we've imposed a one-child policy. We don't want society militarized in the way that it was. But when we've got this one-child policy and we've started opening up to the West, there is a certain dilution of our ideology happening in society. What is the relevance of the Communist Party and Marxism and this control of the party over society? Particularly when there is consumerism coming in, when there is a greater attraction towards material goals, how do we maintain loyalty among people? And you started to look at students who mostly by then were single children, and they were therefore more pampered, and they had greater opportunities, greater wealth was growing, so you were more pampered. So how do you take this pampered lot and make them believe in this sort of core socialist ideology or this sense of collective, that this, as a unit you are a collective as opposed to this individual material goals that you pursue? And they started what was called the University Defense Education. It starts in sort of 1985. And this paper sort of tracks sort of three phases of when this national defense education begins, from 1985 to 89, from 89 to 93, and then 93 onwards till, say, 2012 before Xi Jinping takes power. So that's the period where it covers. And the broad argument that the author makes is that these were the driving forces for starting this military education for students. And when you initially started to do this, you tried to create this sort of sense of loyalty among people, try to drill, create, sort of make them do certain drills, teach them organizational skills, try to inculcate this sense of, you just don't have to look at individual goals. You need to achieve, aspire to a higher quality. And the soldier is this quality individual that you need to aspire to. And this sort of very quickly unravels as the 1980s sort of unfold. And that's because there's greater sense of political empowerment and students start to protest because of political changes happening in the country. And what ends up happening by the time of 1987-89 is this really interesting thing that when these Tiananmen protests and from 87 and then later in 89 start to happen, instead of this education trying to inculcate this sense of party loyalty, the students start to use some of the strategies that they've learned of organization, of sort of holding your lines, of not letting people infiltrate you, to try and protest against the government.
Very interesting. And incidentally, this is the 30th anniversary of the Tiananmen Square uprising.
Yes. So this 4th. Is, it's quite, I mean, I want to quote some of this. So they've spoken to a PLA officer, the author speaks to a PLA officer who was on duty in 1989. And this is what the officer says, that in 1987, police in plain clothes rushed into the groups of students to break them. In 1989, the tactics that I described, which is above, you know, creating squares of, you know, sort of 200 people, which are sort of blocked from all sides, and you've got badges on your chest, which are school badges, so which help you recognize who's in the square with you. So as these cops try to penetrate them, They could not, because there were these school badges, you start to recognize them, and at every 5 meter interval there were these people standing, students standing, creating these formations, and the cops just could not enter them and break them. And that's one of the reasons, was that because these were some of the skills that they had learnt as part of their university defense education. So after this period, sort of the party starts to look at, post Tiananmen analysis, they start to look at things and say, okay, where did we go wrong? Something's obviously not right. And as part of the sort of broader assessment, they say, okay, we need to probably do this at a pilot phase level, which is a very Chinese thing to do. And they then start sort of looking at two universities, Peking and Fudan, which are the premier universities, and they start a one-year course. And that goes on till 1993. After which they say, look at this again, they say that this is not really working, it's not really achieving what we want to achieve, because we also need to try and find a balance between putting a student who's, you know, 18, 19, you know, getting into postgrad, sort of getting into your graduate system, looking at them and saying, the focus of this person is to become an economically viable sort of person, you know, create more value. If this person is going to be spending 1 year learning defense organization, you know, formations, doing drills, running and doing that sort of stuff, am I delaying the sort of economic value that I can derive out of it? And is the balance right? And most students obviously are no longer interested, because they're looking at economic opportunities and they're like, look, this is a waste of my time. So people are going through the motions. So then again, it sort of undergoes this period of relook till sort of more present day. It becomes a case where, okay, you have a 2 week course. So from a year to now 2 weeks. So 2 to 3 weeks. And in that period of time, you are cadets are sent, military cadets are sent to universities, and they sort of orient you into defense education. And a lot of it comprises physical training. And the focus is to build a sense of the collective still. But while you do that, you also want to create this sense of loyalty for the party, given the party's past and the party's militaristic past, given that the revolution was from the Battle of the Gun, it was not a political revolution. And all of the sort of founders of the Communist Party were sort of military, they had associations with the military, which is something that sort of reduced over a period of time. So the idea is to inculcate that sense that you need some of this, you need to respect the party, you need to respect the PLA, and also get a sense of, can you imagine how difficult it is to maintain stability? And the hope is that when students sort of walk away from this, they are not only physically better off, but they're also trained, sort of indoctrinated to the point where they believe that it's actually not that bad a thing that the party and the PLA are around and they are sort of supporting us. And it's actually not even that bad a thing that the party has control over the PLA in the nature that it does. So the idea is to sort of legitimize the party's rule. And reinforce the importance of the People's Liberation Army in that context. But the most sort of fascinating bits is when the author is sort of interviewing students and they talk about what they found interesting. And a number of the students sort of basically go back and say, look, the physical exercise bit was good. It taught me discipline. I had to get up at 6 in the morning. I had to get ready by 6:30. I had to brush my teeth very quickly, which tells you a lot about how students, and these are individuals who were born between 1975 to 1991. So it tells you about a period where these people are growing up when China is growing far more rapidly. And obviously the one-child policy in place. So it tells you about how pampered they were, that you think of brushing your teeth quite early as rush. Right.
So that's the generation that all three of us belong to, incidentally.
Yeah, absolutely. But, we didn't have the benefit of the one-child policy in some way, so that we weren't pampered enough.
Two-child policy.
Yeah, we weren't pampered enough. The idea that sense of discipline is what they are valuing. But beyond that, most of them talk about political indoctrination and courses on Marxism as incredibly boring, as stuff that they had no interest in, but yet they had to just sort of power through. That's essentially what
Chagas. Was there any kind of education for students to get into the military? Like, you know, in the US they have the ROTC, the Reserve Officers Training Corps, which is, you know, you can kind of start on that in university and after that join the army. So was there any sort of pathway to joining the military from university? so, with those courses?
No, I don't think this is the purpose of this is that. So this is not about creating, looking at people and sort of training them to eventually become members of the PLA. That happens at specific universities, which are sort of the National Defense Academies and those sorts of things. This is more about making sure that, so within the Chinese education system, as you sort of grow up from primary to secondary and thereafter, primary, secondary school and thereafter, you go through these ideological courses. So your political courses on Marxism, your ideological courses on the party's history and so on and so forth. But as you reach a university level, this notion of how the parties played a role in the formation of China today is reinforced. And when you reach the university level, the attempt is also to try and bridge the divide between the relevance of the military, the relevance of why the military needs to support the party in a certain way, and why the military is good. And a lot of this comes from, if you go back to Tiananmen again, in many ways, there was a sense of betrayal among these young students, because there was a lot of faith that the soldiers will stand by us. And there's lots of reports which talk about even PLA soldiers finding it very difficult to actually go against the students. There were times where people just refused to shoot, refused to take orders in the PLA. And so that sort of fissure that happened, the sort of break of trust with the PLA, because if you look at what happened at Tiananmen, there were times where sort of these convoys of troops rolled in and they were greeted in Beijing by people holding flowers and sort of telling them that you need to support us and don't you support us and we are Chinese citizens and we are your kin, sort of. Hmm. And then the convoy sort of rolls back. So there's a lot of that happened. And what the action that happened after, when the protests were crushed, essentially led to this sort of breach of trust. So this is partly also reinforcing that sense of, look, firstly, it's good for you at an individual level, doing these courses, doing this stuff, because it makes you a higher quality individual. But also, you need to understand the PLA's role in the broader sort of scheme of things and why it supports the party, because we need the stability. Otherwise, there's absolute chaos to follow.
This is really fascinating, because it seems to me almost as if the party was afraid of bourgeois values infiltrating the armed forces.
I think the sense was that, yes, we need all this. We need these bourgeois values. We need this sort of growth and we need all of that. But how do we sort of maintain our control? Because we went from this period of massive ideology-driven madness to reaching what was in some ways, a sort of middle path, where we said socialism, but with Chinese characteristics, which means that the party should stay there, and the ideology is also not going to be completely dumped, because you can't dump the communist ideology, the Marxist ideology, while remaining a communist party. But we need to change. And it's that sort of flux which leads to some of this.
This reminds me a lot of the second half of the 19th century, after the revolutions of 1848 and as well as the mutiny in India in 1857. A lot of changes in recruitment patterns. So you would have a lot of these conservative European monarchies very careful about where they get their conscript armies from. You know, you only want soldiers from villages. You don't want people from cities who are infected with these political ideas.
Yeah.
And similarly, in India, you have the martial races theory after 1857. We don't want those troublemakers from the east. We want strapping young men from northwest frontier. But does something like that happen in China? Do you have recruitment from specific places?
I don't think I would know enough to actually say that there is recruitment from specific spaces, or even enough about how the PLA goes about recruiting people. But my sense is that there would be... China is not as diverse as India. It's 92% Han. So I don't think that essentially makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
There is an effort, obviously, to get people from all sorts of backgrounds, because particularly from the sort of frontier regions, to try and make sure that the party is sort of supported over there. But I don't think that's necessarily the case. I don't think that's as successful. My sense is that it won't be as successful. I don't have data to support it. But my sense is it's predominantly Han, because when you need to control... So, again, India is very different. So in India, if there is sort of unrest within the borders, you have the Indian armed forces which are going there. And again, there are states forces. And therefore, there are different sort of, you can leverage different ethnic groups and whatever. Because the idea is very different. In China, when there is, say, a problem in Tibet or a problem in Xinjiang, what the predominant strategy has been is to have an influx of Huns. And therefore, you have an influx of troops also, which are Han. Right. Because they would probably be far more comfortable quelling that discontent as opposed to, say, an Uyghur or a Tibetan cadet. But there is, at least in Xinjiang, I know that from the reporting over the last year and a half, we at least know that on sort of the front end of some of these sort of policing actions, forget not the military, but the policing actions, is particularly ethnic Uyghurs, because you want to keep the face of, you know, these are your people, and so that's what you want to try and do. But predominantly it will be Han.
Yeah. So actually I had a question on the first paper. So one of the things it's talking about is getting professionals into the Indian armed teaching. But is there any kind of discussion of getting Indian officers of the army outside to be trained? You know, having them attend master's or PhD level courses outside. Because once again, getting the US example, there are senior, mid-level and senior officers who train at universities as regular students. In my MBA class, I had at least five serving officers of the US Army and Navy and Marines who were doing an MBA course with me.
Yeah. So obviously there aren't a lot of people from the armed forces in universities. And I'm not sure that the armed forces are doing enough to encourage that to happen. And I think that's because they don't see the necessity. And I think that there needs to be a cultural change for that.
That's this level of arrogance that assumes that we know everything and external ideas are of very little value to us.
Yeah, it may or may not be arrogance. I'm sure there are arrogant people, but I think it's also just not knowing.
I think I don't know enough about India to have a conversation on that, but at least from a Chinese point of view, what I do know is that I don't know about business studies and economics and that sort of those sort of things, but at least from a technical education point of view, there is an increasing sort of cross-pollination where a lot of folks from the PLA are studying sort of technical education, scientific education, engineering and those sorts of things. And the idea is to try and actually get at premier universities abroad also to try and learn more and try and then modernize at home. In fact, this is one of the big sort of controversies that's right now sort of brewing with the US in particular, where there are sort of restrictions on Chinese scientists. And one of the reasons why there are these restrictions is because there is a belief that most of these guys are not being entirely honest about their affiliations with the PLA. There are reports, there's a detailed study done by this Australian think tank, I can't remember its name, which talks about a number of students who went to Europe, Australia, the US, who ended up actually being members of the PLA or officers in the PLA. And they did not disclose that when they actually went to study some of these things. So therefore, there is, at least on, say, things like that, there is this cross-pollination.
So that was very interesting. Thank you so much, Aditya. Thanks a lot, Manoj.
Thank you.
Great discussion.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear what you think about this chat. Check us out on our Twitter handle at TakshashilaInst or on our Quora space, All Things Policy. For the latest analysis and research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, visit our website at takshashila.org.in and tune in for our next episode.
Hey, it's been another great week on the IVM Podcast Network. On All Things Policy, Ananya Desai and Rohan Pai discuss recurrent bans on fireworks during festive seasons in India and discuss possible solutions to tackle India's air pollution problem. On the Habit Coach podcast, Ashton Doctor welcomes Sahil Mehta, an esteemed mountaineer and author of the book Break Free. Sahil shares a transformative experience which became the catalyst for embracing discipline and fulfillment. The episode explores the profound impact of vulnerability on personal growth. Folks, if you like our shows, do spread the word. Tell your friends and don't forget to rate and review them wherever you're listening to them. Follow us on social media. We are IVM Podcasts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. You'll also find all our shows on YouTube at youtube.com/IVM Podcasts. And finally, we would like to thank our sponsors this week. Omidyar Network India, Abbott, IDFC First Bank and Save Life Foundation. Thank you for making this possible.